Okay, well, I am. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic still.
Hi, Chris.
You know, a little bit about my experience with Fellowship of the Spirit. As it was mentioned earlier, the Fellowship of the Spirit really started out in Colorado, and it started with some people who became incredibly influential to me. There was a Denver Young People's Group and a bunch of people that were involved with that who really, really ended up becoming my spiritual mentors. So Fellowship of the Spirit, these conferences mean a lot to me. I get the opportunity to do a number of things, and it's always special to be able to come and share at a Fellowship of the Spirit, because I believe it goes directly back to my teachers. I remember probably the most fun event I've ever done in my life was, I think it was the 2007 Fellowship of the Spirit, when I did it with our friend Peter M. and Mark H. and Doug M. That was just a lot of fun. There's, you know, the New York crowd, the New York people just have a wonderful presence and a wonderful attitude. And you know, I was really, 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 really touched to be called up today and say, hey, you want to pinch hit for this? And I had to check with my wife, and I was just hoping she was going to say yes, you know what I mean? And I got lucky, and here I am. Carrie and I are going to do a session. We're going to talk a little bit about step one. We're going to mix it up a little bit with our story so that you know we're, you know, sitting behind the right mic. And I think step one is quite possibly the most misunderstood step in Alcoholics Anonymous or any of the fellowships today. People pay lip service to it, but don't fully understand the ramifications of an admission of alcoholism. I was fast on the way to drinking myself to death in the 80s. I started partying in the very late 60s, and I made it through almost through the entire 80s, partying like a maniac. And I understood that alcohol was going to take me out real soon. I got so chronic with my drinking that toward the end, I'd need to be detoxed. I would go into the DTs, and it was not pretty when I was separated from alcohol. So I knew alcohol was going to kill me, but that ain't half the problem. You know, I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is go to treatment, and then I'm going to stop drinking, and then everything is going to be fine. Well, guess what? Everything wasn't fine. Everything was very far from fine when I separated from alcohol after putting myself in treatment. I was going absolutely out of my mind. Ended up relapsing. Ended up going back out for about 5 or 6 or 7 months of the absolute worst drinking ever. And then I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous between Christmas and New Year's of 1989, and I think what saved me was having a sense of urgency about Alcoholics Anonymous and my participation in it. I had a willingness that was born of sheer desperation, but again, I didn't understand what the first step was. I knew I had to quit drinking, but if you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you view your problem, you continue to view your problem as drinking alcohol, and that's all you see, you could be missing a lot. And I'll describe it by telling a short story. The last 3 or 4 years of my drinking, what would happen is I would get off of work. I had a terrible job. I was a bad electrician. I was blowing stuff up on a daily basis. It was just not good. I was getting electrocuted like all the time, or electrocuting other people all the time. It was a mess. But But anyway, what would happen is I would get off of work. You know, I mean, work ended at 4:30, and I would haul ass to the liquor store. I mean, if you were doing 30 in a 40 mile an hour speed, you know, in front of me or something, I would run you off the road. I was on a mission. And I would go to the liquor store, and I had a certain liquor store that I went to, and if it was winter, I'd be drinking bourbon. If it was summer, I'd be drinking vodka. I knew right where it was. I was in the liquor store. I'd grab my bottle. I'd go up, and I'd pay for it, and I'd head home, you know, 100 miles an hour. And the second I got home, the first thing I did was pour a gigantic drink. And that was basically my day. Now, I remember this one time. I get to the liquor store, I run up, I grab my vodka, and there's somebody in line in front of me. And it's this woman, and this woman is talking to the checkout guy. She's going, "Do you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia?" And the guy's going, "Well, I think that there's a Chardonnay from the California region with quite a nice bouquet, you know, it goes well with white fish." Now, I am freaking out, right? I'm like, "Are you crazy? Are you crazy? Wine with fish? What are you, nuts? Get that lady out of here, you know? Give her a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of my way. I need to buy this vodka, and I need to get out of here. I got a problem. I'm sober." You know what I mean? I'm sober, and I can't stand it one more second. Now think about this. Think about this. Is alcohol really my problem? You know, I'm viewing alcohol as a solution to an incredibly messed up psycho-spiritual emotional problem that I have, the bondage of Chris, right? I mean, that's what I'm basically dealing with. I cannot, sobriety's intolerable. It's untenable to me. So I need alcohol to check out. I need to go away from this reality. Now, you know, there's been a lot of really amazing people who've studied alcoholism, who've studied addiction, and there's been some people who I believe were really enlightened as far as what our problem really was. And a couple of them were the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. They understood that you do not fight alcoholism with sobriety. They had tried it 1,000 times. You fight it with spirituality and spiritual living. That's how we address our alcoholism. That's how we participate in the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And we hopefully place ourselves in the sunlight of the Spirit so that God can do what God does, which is keep us separated from alcohol and enable our lives to come back together. Now, if you're working on the wrong problem, you know, if you've got the wrong problem, you're working on the wrong solution. And that's what happened when I first came in to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was working on not taking one drink one day at a time, because that's what I was hearing. And there were some people who were with me. They were like this, "I'm just not drinking today." You know what I mean? "Even if my ass falls off, I ain't taking a drink. I'm a winner." "Do you want what I have?" "No, no, please no." So what I was doing was working on the wrong problem. Now, I'm not saying that it's not important for us to stay separated from alcohol. It absolutely is. Everything starts with separating from the drink. Because I don't know that you can engage in a spiritual process when you're self-centeredly drinking yourself to death. There definitely has to be that separation. But that's not what we work on. We don't do this to alcohol. Just stay over there. We don't do it that way. What we do is we engage in a spiritual process. So when we're looking at step one, we need to understand that alcohol is going to kill us, but alcoholism is our problem. It's the ism that's going to drive us out of our mind. It's the ism that pushes us back to alcohol because we just can't take it anymore. We can't take it one more minute. Those AAs are out of their minds. I don't understand. This time it's going to be different. You know, all the crazy things that we say when we put alcohol back in our body. Now Bill Wilson understood this. There's a number of people that have understood it in the past. There was a wonderful speaker out of California. This guy was absolutely beloved. His name was Chuck C. He's gone many decades now. But he kind of changed the landscape as far as how people gave talks at AA groups. Up until that time, mainly what you would hear is you would hear drunkalogs. Well, all of a sudden, Chuck C. comes around and he starts to give spiritual talks in the AA groups. You know, he'd be asked to speak and he'd talk about spiritual principles and spiritual living. And he became very, very beloved. He probably five nights out of seven, he was speaking somewhere. People loved him. And he would say something that when I first heard it, didn't make a lot of sense to me, but makes a lot of sense to me now. He said, this is one of the things that he would say. He would say, there's only one problem, and within that problem are all other problems. And there is only one solution, and within that solution are all other solutions. And the problem is a separation from God. And the solution is connection to God. And how I view alcoholism these days and how I view drug addiction these days is an incredible separation from the comfort of the divine. In other words, I'm behind the tilapia lady in line. I'm out of my mind. Now, my first 6 months in AA, I was behind the tilapia lady every day. You know what I mean? I was like, argh. I remember my hand would get really numb because I was clenching my fist like this. For like the first 6 months, I was whacked out of my mind with alcoholism. I mean, it's so spiritually aggressive, alcoholism, that, you know, I don't know how I made it. I don't know how I stayed sober, except from the absolute grace of God, because it was like being behind the tilapia lady, you know, 14 hours a day for 6 months. Now when you look at step one, you see the physical craving. They talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the doctor's opinion and the first two chapters are pretty much on step one. There is a solution more about alcoholism, pretty much. They contain a lot of information, but there's specifically about and on step one. And in the book, he nails it. Bill nails it. And I got to tell you, one of the things that I do today is I have a lot of interaction with professional addictive illness treatment. I'm on a couple of boards, and I'm always doing something, and it's symposiums or workshops or whatever, and I really get around the professional addictive illness and alcoholism treatment people. And I've got to tell you this, that probably 8 out of 10 treatment centers and 8 out of 10 treatment professionals don't even understand what the problem is, and you are paying them to treat you. They think that your problem is a lack of medication, or your problem can be solved with a list of triggers. You know, just watch out for these triggers. Listen, folks, the first step in the problem of alcoholism is much bigger than that. It's gigantic, because here's what it starts with. It starts with a physical allergy, a physical craving, which means this is what it looks like. This is how it presents. The first drink is always going to do one thing. It's going to ask for the second. The second is going to insist on the third, and the third is going to demand the fourth. And the more alcohol in your body, the more the craving is present. That's why we get passed out, blacked out, drunk, tongue chewing, knee walking, not able to operate our own pants zipper drunk. It's because of that craving. Now, the real tricky part is the obsession of the mind. This is where probably 7 out of 10 alcoholics in AA don't even realize how big the problem is. You know, we are all minimizing, because this is basically what the obsession of the mind is. We have no adequate defense on our own power. We've got no adequate defense against putting alcohol in our body. In other words, we're powerless. Powerless. We are not in charge of when alcohol is going to go back in our body. That's what powerlessness means. There's a power that can work in you and through you that can keep you separated from alcohol. Absolutely. But it ain't you. You know, so on our own unaided will, we can wish to not drink anymore. Here's a story from my experience. I signed myself into a 28-day treatment center. Nobody was pushing me there. I signed myself in because I was in trouble. I got out of 28 days and they told me you should go to outpatient. So I signed up for outpatient. They told me I should go to some AA meetings. So I was going to AA meetings. I told everybody in my life I'm done drinking. I told my boss, I told my family, I am through. I am absolutely through. And I got to tell you, there's not a person in any of the AA meetings I was going to that wanted to stay separated from alcohol more than me. I was absolutely done with it. And on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that if I bought a gallon of vodka and I drank it, it would help me do this AA stuff better. I would remember what it's like to be drunk and hungover, and I would increase my participation in this recovery stuff. So I got drunk to improve my sobriety. I now really have full understanding of what the obsession of the mind can look like. Alcohol doesn't care how it goes back in your body. If it has to convince you that it's good for your sobriety, that's what it'll do. So, and here's what happened. I'm pouring out the vodka and I'm drinking. Good idea. This is a good idea. I had a second one. This is good. I like the way I think. I start into the third glass of vodka and I start to get drunk and I go, oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door to the beast and the beast is going to drag me around for who knows how long. How stupid could I have been? So think about this. They talk about being restored to sanity in the second step. Was I insane before I got drunk or after I got drunk? I was insane before. It was nuts to start drinking. It was nuts to believe that alcohol would improve my sobriety, but I did it anyway. And the alcohol restored me to sanity. Once I started to get drunk, I realized the enormity of my mistake. So, you know, I've got firsthand experience with the obsession of the mind. Listen, when we tell our loved ones that we're done forever, we mean it. When we tell our boss, I will never show up drunk again ever, we mean it. When we tell the judge, Your Honor, I swear, I'm through, we mean it. And if you hooked us up to a lie detector, it would say we're telling the truth. The problem is we have a lack of power. We've got lack of choice and we've got lack of control. We don't have it. It's not available. There's some great sections in this book that talk exactly about that. So I've got a body that's going to ensure I'm going to die drinking because I'm going to poison myself with it every night. And I've got a mind that won't let me stay away from it. So really, the only problem I got is when I'm drinking or when I'm not drinking. If it wasn't for those two problems, I'd probably be all right. But there's actually a third problem. And the third problem is the unmanageability. I love the way this book, the big book, talks about unmanageability. It's spread throughout the book. That, you know, there's not like one chapter on to the unmanageable or something. You have to kind of dig to find it. But basically, using big book terminology, here's how unmanageability would present to me. Because I thought unmanageability was the DUIs, the family walking out. Those are consequences of being a horse's ass. Okay? That's not the unmanageability of alcoholism. Here's a good day. Separate. Now, remind you, I want to let you know, I'm going to be talking about being separated from alcohol in a sober state, in between drinks. On a good day, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. On a normal day, I'm prey to misery and depression. I can't control my emotional nature. I suffer from guilt, shame, remorse, self-centered fear, anxiety. That's like a normal day. On a bad day, the hideous four horsemen stampede through my head. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Anybody ever been there? Let's see a show of hands. Anybody ever been... let the record show all 800 people raise their hand. These tapes are going back to my home group. Anyway. CDs. Yeah,
you just said how old you were, by the way.
Okay.
On the speaker tapes.
Yeah, right. So a little bit on step one. Listen, step one is a bear, guys. We all minimize. If we truly understood the enormity of what alcoholism can do to us, we would be so much better at prayer and meditation. We would be working with people. You know, we would be doing spot check inventories, semi-annual house cleanings. I mean, we'd be all over this. But inherent in the illness is an almost utter inability to accurately assess just how much trouble we're in. So we got to watch out for that, too. That's why we need to be held accountable by sponsors and spiritual advisors and home group fellowship. And stuff like that, because this is a big problem. And this weekend, Carrie and I and some of the other speakers are going to be talking about not just the problem, but the solution. Because I got to tell you, this failed proctologist and New York State stock shyster came up with something absolutely marvelous. And we're going to be sharing some of that this weekend, Carrie.
Hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. I was thinking about, Chris covered a lot when it came to step one, and what we really wanted to do, and what I think is really important when you do these big book workshops, you know, you're going to be listening to us all weekend. And part of it is to kind of identify, and you know, you kind of have to like us, you have to want what we have, so you have to get to know who we are. And I was thinking about all the years that that I spent in AA drinking. I'm one of those products of, like, you know, I mean, like, I got sober at 18. My parents went to Al-Anon. I'm in a one of five Irish Catholic children. So you know that we had some substance abusers preceding me because I'm the youngest. So my parents went to Al-Anon. So they learned these things. Like, you know, there's this, you know, fellowship in this place that, you know, you send your, you know, alcoholic drug addict daughter and kick her out the house and send her to this church basement and they'll fix her. You know, send her to treatment, you know, get her shrinks and everything will all be okay. So I spent 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous drinking, from the age of 13 to the age of 18. And never once did anybody hand me a big book. Never once did anybody say, you know, the solution to your problem is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we're in a 12-step fellowship, and we don't even work the 12 steps. I mean, that's really funny. Think about that for a minute. You know, I'll be in an AA meeting and I'll be sharing about step recovery and somebody will come up and be like, don't confuse the newcomer. I'm like they weren't confused when they walked in the door. Oh, so I'm just gonna let them die. So I'm not a very controversial speaker, but people tend to get up and leave when I'm talking because I don't care. I'm going to curse. I'm a foul-mouthed little hooligan. I'm going to tell you what I think, and you're not probably going to like it. I probably won't say it in a very ladylike manner, because the only thing that's ladylike about me is this dress. Because the fact is this is a deadly disease. I died in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was dead for 2 minutes by my own hand while attending AA fucking meetings, because nobody gave me the solution to my problem, which was a relationship with a higher power and 12 steps to get that. I came into AA meetings, and I thought that I needed to make dances, make coffee, I thought that I needed to talk about my problems. I thought that I needed to, you know, have something interesting to share and hang out with my network of people. And, you know, we, you know, decided to go on a caravan to Newark to COP after meetings pretty regularly, actually. I was like, who wants to relapse? Yes! You know, Bloomfield Young People's, which is where I got sober and drank a lot. It was like kind of the thing. It's like, well, is the half the home group relapsing this week? I guess so, because they're all down in Newark. So that's, you know, that's the kind of recovery that I was introduced to. And we wonder, you know, and I think about it, and I think about the fact that, you know, that this type of recovery that we're going to be talking about this weekend, and this type of recovery, this is recovery. And I am actually a treatment professional, by the way. So, but I actually, you know, present a solution, you know, not fluffy, let's talk about your inner child and take a bath and a, you know, and let's whine about mom and dad. And I'm like, no, you're your problem. You know, God is your solution. Let's get about that. But anyway, I know. I get paid the big bucks for telling people, you know, to go to AA and read a big book. Actually, you know, I could just say that. I could just, like, the 12 steps are here. Read this. Don't let anybody read your big book, including me. Get a sponsor. Get a home group. Bye. I'm done for the weekend. Because there's really nothing more that needs to be said. But you know what? Part of what coming to Fellowship of the Spirit and doing these kinds of workshops and doing big book workshops, and it's about a sense of community. When I first got introduced to the 12 steps, I was living in Staten Island. I had been spent 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous drinking, dying, committing suicide. I think I had 6 suicide attempts, 1 actual death, several internments in psych wards. Yes, 4-point restraints were one of my favorite things, because I learned that if you threw yourself on the floor and said, Daddy, don't hit me anymore, they shot you up with drugs. But the problem was they would tie you down. It was a cost-benefit analysis. I was okay with it, you know. So, you know, I spent years around here doing things like that. You know, I would, like, I used to think, like, the most sober person in the room was, like, the person, like, with the coolest problem in an open discussion meeting. I almost called it open disgusting. I know, I'm bad. I'm bigoted. but I used to think that was, like, the most sober person in the room. So, like, I would, like, watch, like, soap operas because, like, you know, I was forever expelled or suspended from school. And I would watch the soap operas and, like, make up problems to come to the meeting and share that night about whatever it was. So, like, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and made up problems because I didn't know what my problem was, just like Chris was talking about. I didn't know why I kept drinking. I didn't know why my parents would drop me off at the front door of a church with a dollar and I would sneak out the back and get drunk. I don't know why when I said, you know, I really want to stop this. I really don't want to drink anymore. I mean, I remember I was 16 years old and, you know, I had spent a year semi-separated from alcohol. And what I mean by that is, like, my parents decided to move me into the Pennsylvania, actually where I live now, which is kind of funny. They kind of thought, well, like, they should get me out of New Jersey and send me to the woods in Pennsylvania. And, like, you know, that it was the kids or the people I was hanging out with that had something to do with, my aberrant behavior, such as throwing up on their floor and stealing from them and things like that. I mean, you know, it must have been my friends, right? They were doing those, you know. So my parents sent me to the Poconos, and you know, it was difficult to have access to what I needed to have access to because, you know, I didn't have a car. I was underage. It was difficult to find dirty old men to buy me booze, you know. So I managed to, like, have some periods of, like, you know, not drinking. You know, I was miserably depressed, slept 14 hours a day, and, you know, attempted suicide twice that year, but I managed to do really well in school. Surprisingly, I had this brain. Like, if I wasn't drunk, I was actually smart. So I managed to get into a very prestigious prep school. At the end of that year, they expelled me from the school that I was in, by the way. I have been expelled from 5 high schools, including the special kid school. I was on the short bus, and they told me not to come anymore. They were like, you know, really, the school with the kids with the behavioral problems, like the fire setters and stuff, didn't want me. They were like, you know, you could just stop coming now. Don't come back. But anyway, I managed to get into this prestigious prep school. And I remember, like, I just was like, you know, I have this opportunity to start over. Nobody has to know that I'm an alcoholic. Nobody has to know that I've been in 37 rehabs. Nobody has to know that I'm crazy. Nobody has to know any of these things. Like, I can start over, and I could just be whoever I want to be, right? So, you know, you ever do that? Ever pretend to be somebody else who you want people to see you as? you know, and you kind of put up this front, but deep down inside, you know you're not this person, and you have that terror of being found out, and the cracks start to show, and people start to see that, you know, what you're presenting to the world isn't really necessarily what you are. You ever do that? Yeah. So that started to happen. I was walking home from school one day, and someone came up to me and said, "Want a drink?" I said, "Sure." I hadn't had a drink in 6 months. I had an opportunity, a great opportunity. My entire family was incredibly proud of me. I had a complete opportunity to start over and be somebody else. And I couldn't do it because the power to do that was not within me. And I remember drinking, and I remember having that drink, and I remember thinking, fuck, everything I just worked for, everything I just did. You know, in the big book, it talks about, you know, the alcoholic building up this life for the loved ones, the family, right? And then we rip it asunder with a senseless series of sprees. So I put that alcohol in my body, and I knew. I absolutely knew. I knew I couldn't drink. I knew I couldn't live without drinking. I knew that AA didn't work because I had been coming there now for 3 years and couldn't not drink. So I ate the medicine cabinet and died. Woke up 5 days later really pissed and intubated because, like, no, God didn't even want me. AA can't sober me up. My parents can't fix me. Rehab doesn't work. You know, I can't pretend to be somebody else. And I have nowhere to go. And I was in that state for 2 years. In and out of the rooms, in and out, in and out. And not one person said to me, "Why don't you read this book? We have a solution." There's a freaking chapter called "There is a Solution." You want to hide something from an alcoholic, put it in the damn big book. But I mean, my point to this is, as we come to things like this, to weekends like this, you know, not necessarily to get information on how to work the steps, because that's what a sponsor's for. You know, if you're getting your sponsorship from this table, that's not sponsorship. This is inspiration. We're going to talk about our experience with the steps. We're going to talk about the things that we've done, the things that we've been shown through this process, and hopefully inspire you to have your own experience. But this isn't sponsorship. Sponsorship is sitting down at your kitchen table, eyeball to eyeball with another human being, and going through this big book word by word, paragraph by paragraph. That is sponsorship. Now, if it wasn't for weekends like this, if it wasn't for speaker tapes, because I'm that old too, you know, if it wasn't for guys like Joe and Charlie, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair. Because I wouldn't have been able to gain access to the information that told me where the solution to my problem was. Actually, that told me what my problem was first, and then told me where the solution to my problem was. You know, because alcohol, as an alcoholic, I externalize everything. You ever like have one of those days, and it was everybody else's fault but yours? You know, like, you know, it was traffic, your boss sucks, you know, your husband sucks, the kids suck, you know, everything sucks, right? The common denominator in that situation is me. But I externalize and blame everything on everybody else. My belief really was is that my alcoholism was causal. I understood that I was powerless. I understood that I was screwed. I mean, I wouldn't have eaten the medicine cabinet and actually died if I thought that there was any hope for my life. I mean, at 16 years old, I had no hope. I remember I had a bullet. I actually showed it to my now husband when we met. And I was like, well, you know, you realize that if I don't stop drinking by the time I'm 21, I'm going to kill myself. So, you know, you got a couple years with me. But last time I ate the medicine cabinet, that didn't work. So I think this time I'm going to use a gun. That was the conversation we had on, like, our second date. What's really strange is he didn't run. That was a warning sign. But anyway, that's a whole other story. That's called sex inventory. But I have a point to this. And my point is this, is that for me, I really believe that I drank because of things that other people did to me. I thought I drank because I grew up in an alcoholic household. I thought I drank because, you know, I wasn't loved appropriately by my parents because, you know, I decide how they should love me and they should execute it accordingly to my standards. And if you fail to do so, then I'm not loved. I thought that I was a paste eater, okay? I've never been a cool kid. I'm still not a cool kid. You know, I spoke at Icky Paw like 2 weeks ago. It was like 4,000 people, and it was awesome. And like, I was the paste eater in the corner, you know. And I'm like the main speaker, and I'm the paste eater in the corner. And they're like, "Aren't you the speaker?" And they're like, "I'm like, yeah." They're like, "You were great." I'm like in the corner, you know, because I've never been one of those people. Like, I've always been somebody. I've always felt shy, inadequate, full of fear. Now, in sobriety, I mean, I've 18 years of sobriety, and I have, you know, 16 years of consistently working the steps. I mean, I can sit in a table in front of you guys, and I can talk about some of the most intimate things in my life. I could talk about God. I could talk about alcoholism. I could talk about the Big Book. I can be a channel, an agent of God's will. But, you know, you catch me in the corner, and I'm, like, looking at the floor, and, you know, counting ceiling tiles, because I'm not the most, you know, outgoing person. I'm actually rather shy. With that being said, you know, I went through my life, and I really believe that what was wrong with me had to do with you. That what was wrong with me was that, you know, I wasn't liked, I wasn't loved, that I wasn't pretty enough, that my boobs were not big enough, that I didn't have the right boyfriend, I didn't have the right family, I didn't come from the right socioeconomic status bracket, and that if I could fix those things on the outside, that I would be okay, you know? And if I was okay inside, then I wouldn't need to drink, right? You know what that's called? It's called polishing the brass on the Titanic. But I really believe that. And what this book taught me, what the first step taught me, was that the problem has absolutely nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with whether or not my boobs are big enough. It has nothing to do about what kind of money I have in the bank or what kind of job that I have. And it has everything to do with that engine of my disease, my spiritual malady. Because the fact is that the drink, you know, they talk about the desperate experiment of the first drink, right? Now, the desperate experiment, I mean, that's the most perfect description of picking up the first drink, right? Because one, I don't really know what's going to happen after the first one, except for the second. And third, and fourth, and, you know, then maybe the bottle and, you know, the gallon. But desperate. That's the word we miss a lot, isn't it? The desperation of the untreated alcoholic. Who here has blotted out the intolerableness of your situation with something other than booze? Food, men, money, prestige, ego? Yeah. Exactly. Because when I'm in that state of untreated alcoholism, I'm going to fill that hole with anything that I can grab onto. At first, and this is the thing, is like when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they say, you know, the first drink gets you drunk, you know, I have to try a bunch of different stuff before I go back to the bottle, because I got burned by the bottle, you know? The bottle kicked my ass. I'm not going back to the bottle first thing out, right? I'm going to change the boyfriend. You know, I get a better boyfriend, you know, with a better car, with a little bit more money, and, you know, maybe I'm going to feel a little better about myself. And then I'm going to get the haircut, you know, when you get the haircut and the highlights and the nails done, because, you know, you're trying to fix up the outside because the inside feels like shit, you know? So I start with that. I start externalizing, you know, and then slowly but surely those things don't work. They're called human powers. I love Bill's story, and I love Bill's story, the first 8 pages of Bill's story, because it has the coolest thing ever. Bill details every single human power he used to not just, you know, not just stop. I mean, I could drink and put the bottle down, but stay away from the bottle. Staying stopped is a problem for the alcoholic, not the stopping. Bill details every single way that he used, every human power that he used to stay stopped. You know, in the book it talks about, it says we're as hopeless as Bill, you know, meaning a hopeless alcoholic like Bill. And what the book is talking about is, did all the human powers that failed Bill, did they fail for me too? And the human powers that failed Bill, I mean, he swore on the Bible, right? He wrote sweet promises to Lois. He used ego, pride. He could laugh at the gin mills, right? Geographical cure, right? He went to Toronto. He went from country and back again, right? He tried, what else did he try? Swaying before the medicine cabinet, suicide, right? Jumping out the window. Sedatives, which are my favorites. Sedatives and booze, yeah. That's a great combination, land you on the rocks. He used fear, hospitalization, self-knowledge. And I'm sure there's more in there because I'm just going off the top of my head. But the idea here is all of those human powers failed Bill. And all of those human powers failed me. So when I read through the first 8 pages of that chapter and I look at all the ways that Bill tried to control his drinking or stay stopped, and none of those things worked for Bill. None of those things worked for me. The real question is, what is it that I need to do in order to maintain abstinence from alcohol? Well, Bill tells us in his story, he says that it's a relationship with his higher power. He talks about faith without works is dead. He talks about service. He said that working with another alcoholic helped in rough going. He talks about common sense becomes uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt. I think we call that meditation. I think. You know, so the idea here is that first I have to stop externalizing my problem and realize the problem has to do with me. It has to do with my perceptions, my life, the way that I perceive the world. That the engine of my disease, the reason why the drink looks like a good idea, why I make that desperate experiment of the first drink, is because I'm ruled by self-centered fear. That self-centered fear creates the things that Chris was talking about, but the problems with personal relationships, can't control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, can't make a living, can't seem to be of real help to other people, full of fear, feelings of uselessness. Right? Page 52, the bedevilments. Yeah, my sponsor didn't make me write that stuff out like 3 times a year for like the past, I don't know, 19 years that I actually haven't memorized. But the idea here is that though that self-centered fear is the thing that creates that state within myself that makes the drink look like a good idea, that I seek the relief of the first drink and I drink because I like the effect that it produces. And though I see other people drinking with impunity, right? That's the other thing, the alcoholic mind. The alcoholic mind watches alcohol. You know, I don't watch alcohol anymore. I don't. The only time I pay attention to alcohol is when I'm out with people who drink, and I'm at a dinner, and I just pay attention to make sure I don't pick up their glass. But essentially, I don't watch alcohol. It's inert substance to me, because I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. So alcohol could be gasoline. I'm not going to drink it. Would you guys drink gasoline? Who here thinks it's a great idea to drink gasoline? Okay. Alcohol. The exact same thing. Not a good idea to drink it. Have no desire to do so. How'd that happen? An experience with the 12 steps and a personal relationship with a higher power. How did I get that? Because somebody took the time to sit down with me and read this book word by word, chapter by chapter, and have the experience with me. There are clear-cut directions to a spiritual experience. And I'm going to wrap this up real quick, and then I'm going to turn it over to Chris. There's this great analogy, and this is not me. I'm not really that smart. In fact, 90% of everything that you're going to hear come out of my mouth is probably something that somebody has taught me. Because I'm probably one of the luckiest girls in Alcoholics Anonymous, because like I got sober in the ground floor of the Big Book Revolution, which this guy right here was a big part of. Like I was like his test subject. It would be like, oh, let's try this new exercise, spiritual exercise. Does it work on girls? Let's give it to Carrie, and if she doesn't drink, then it's good. You know? I was like the Big Book guinea pig of New Jersey. And all of these Big Book demigods and gurus would wander through this home group, and I would be like, tell me more! And I'd be standing out in the parking lot saying, how do you know you've had a spiritual experience? And of course, the answer was, well, when you stop asking me that question, you will. I was like, can you tell? Did it happen yet? And they would just laugh because I was like 23 years old and on fire and insane. But anyway, there's a point to this. This is a wonderful analogy. It says that, you know, that the 12 steps are a recipe for an experience with God, right? Now, with anything, there's recipe, there's certain ingredients, certain steps, certain times, and kind of like a recipe or a way that things need to be done, right? Like, you have to sift the flour. Now, we're not talking about Betty Crocker, just open the damn thing and throw eggs in it. I'm talking like a good old-fashioned, like, Martha Stewart cake. right? There's a certain process that one has to engage in order to make this cake, right? You know, we have to like put baking soda and eggs. I really don't make these very often. In fact, I don't really cook all that often at all. But you get the idea that there's certain things that need to go into this thing. If I decide that I'm not going to put, you know, oil in it, right? I'm going to put like, you know, water and just water, no oil. And I decide that I'm not going to put eggs in it. Instead, I'm going to put just extra vanilla, right? And I stick it in the oven. Am I going to have a cake? No. I'm going to have a gooey mess. So the idea here is that 12 steps are a recipe for a spiritual experience. We can always add to. You can add raisins to that cake. You can add walnuts to that cake. You can put little pretty things on it. You can put flowers on it. You can make the cake as pretty as you want. You can add to it. But we don't take away that the 12 steps are the foundation for that recipe for the spiritual experience. Put out all the flourishes you want. But the bones, the support, the scaffold of that spiritual experience is the 12 steps. So when I'm talking about this, I'm not telling you that your experience or what you do or what you, all of this stuff, I'm not trying to invalidate it. But what I'm asking you to do is to lay aside the experiences that you may have had previously and have an open mind about what we're talking about. Because the idea here is, I want to be able to give you some information that you can take home with you and have an experience, be on fire, be inspired to have a new experience with the 12 steps. If you've had one last year, great, have a new one. Really? Can you have too much cake? Who can really have too much cake? So think about that. It's like, well, I had a spiritual experience with the 12 steps 14 years ago. I don't need another one, goddammit. Really? You're not a whole lot of fun. Anyway, so Chris, do you want to?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, there's a couple of sections here in the book that I want to read. One is on page 24, one paragraph down. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Mm-hmm. And I want to skip forward a little bit to page 39, second paragraph down. The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Now, you know, we can read that and we can kind of understand it a little bit intellectually, but what has to happen for step one is a full concession to our innermost selves that we are alcoholic. And what is an alcoholic? They're describing an alcoholic there. Someone who is unable at certain times to be able to stay separated from alcohol. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous today, is everybody that's showing up in the doors of AA a low-bottom, hopeless alcoholic like they're talking about in this book? I don't believe so. I believe that there are people who are getting here before they have to go down the scale that far. And that is good and that is well. And, you know, that is an important thing to have happen. If you can avoid alcoholic pain, you know, please, you know, go for it. But every once in a while, I get to work with the alcoholic that's described in this book. And it can be heartbreaking. It can be heartbreaking. Sometimes they'll get it. Sometimes they will get it. And they will exert every single ounce of energy they have into working a spiritual program. And they're going to be fine. Those are the people who are going to be able to get through the steps. But there are some people, and Bill is great at explaining this, who cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. They either cannot or will not. Bill doesn't say that they're idiots or they're lazy. He basically says they either cannot or will not. That's very non-judgmental. And there are people who cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program, and I see them die all the time. And you know, there can be two reasons. there can be two reasons for somebody not getting it if they show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Bill. One of them is they are not given the solution. They're not presented with the problem and the solution by us as fellowship members. And the other is they've been presented with this information. We've offered our help to show them, you know, what the problem is and what the solution is, and they've decided not to do it. Every once in a while, I get one of those guys. I had somebody back when who showed up, you know, at a meeting, and oh, they heard me speak or something. They said, "Oh, will you help me? Will you help me? Oh my God, my life! Oh, you know." And they started going through the drama. You ever work with somebody? They're telling you about the drama. You know, they're thrown out of the house. They lost the job. You know, the cops are looking for them. They're going to drive when there's jets and mobiles. They've lost their license for so long, you know. And it's just like one drama after another. And you know, one of the things that I try to do is I try to qualify somebody. I think it's very, very important to follow the chapter working with others when you're working with somebody new. And I try to qualify them. And, you know, I become convinced they're alcoholic by asking them some simple questions and having them share with me some of their experience. And I can become convinced pretty quickly whether they are or whether they aren't. And, you know, I'll get somebody. I had this one guy who you know, I basically stopped him and I go, "Look, you know, I need to tell you, I'm pretty convinced that you're an alcoholic. Now, alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. If you don't put it in remission through the practice of spiritual principles, it will kill you. And by the time it kills you, it's going to have robbed every bit of quality from your life. We go out in absolute disgrace. There won't be a person left in your life that cares anything at all about you. They're either going to pity you or hate you. And you are going to check out in complete disgrace. It's a mess. You're going to suffer like you have no idea. You know, if you don't put this into remission, do you understand?" "Yeah." "Okay, now here's what I want you to do. I want you to come over to my house, you know, tomorrow night, and we're gonna get busy. You know, bring your big book. We're gonna sit down, and I'm gonna start helping you to move through the steps, because the steps is the treatment for alcoholism. I don't care what your counselor told you. You know, the treatment for alcoholism is not meeting attendance." It's having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. So let's get going on these steps. So you're going to be, here's my address. I'll see you tomorrow night. "Oh, wow, man. Tomorrow night?" "You know, I'm having my feet scraped tomorrow night. And, okay, how about Wednesday? Can you do Wednesday?" "Well, you know, I'm not going to be available because I'm getting ready to tour with the dead. You know, I always tour with the dead in the summer." And I'm like, you know, I mean, this actually happened. And I'm like, what part of this don't you understand? You're dying. You're going to tour with the dead. You're going to be dead pretty soon. You know, what is the matter with you?" Yeah, I said Grateful Dead back then. By the way, you know, back in the day, you know, when people would go to the Grateful Dead concerts, there were yellow balloons for the sober people. So anyway, I had to throw that in for the Grateful Dead people. But anyway, you know, here's the thing. I am right in this guy's face. I am explaining the problem. I'm explaining the solution. I'm getting him to say yes. You know, yeah. But he has an utter inability to accurately assess his own problem. He thinks that he can just go to the yellow balloons at the Dead show and everything's going to be fine. This guy is overreacting in front of me. You know what I mean? He's talking all this stuff at me. And so a lot of times these guys cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. What is our responsibility? Our responsibility is to share this information with them and to be available if they want to tell their story, if they want to start moving through the steps. We need to be available. But this first step, folks, is not easy. Every single one of us has experience minimizing what this first step is actually saying. This first step is actually saying it's Custer's last stand and there's more Indians coming over the hill. Good luck. That's what this first step is saying. I mean, it's that bad. It's when you start looking at the second step that it's saying that you may survive this. You may survive this if you pay attention to what we have to say. Now, you know, I gotta tell you something. Most people who have alcoholism die from it. Way in the 90 percentile range of alcoholics die from alcoholism. I want to be the type of person who dies with alcoholism, not from alcoholism. Now, one of the things that I do a lot is I have interaction with treatment professionals, you know. And this one time I made the mistake of going on a LinkedIn group, and you know, one of these professional addiction groups, you know, where everybody gets on there and tries to find new clients for their sober coaching or whatever. And I'm on this site, and this one guy is kind of pissing me off. So, you know, I put some comment in, and here's what his comment back was, because he was kind of disparaging Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. And that bothers me, okay, because Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. It saved my life. So when somebody criticizes it, not that I don't criticize it, but if somebody else besides me criticizes it, I have a hard time. And here's what he said. This is what this treatment professional said. This is what this individual that charges you $200 an hour to help you with your alcoholism said. I don't send anybody to AA. AA's success rate is somewhere around 6%. I could get better results with a placebo. Think about that. Now I freaked out. I freaked out, okay? But I had to listen to what this guy was saying. First of all, he's right. They take these statistics by standing in front of the door at the closed-minded discussion meetings, okay? And as you come through, they ask you, you know, are you in AA? How long you been in AA? You know, all this stuff. And they can keep track of people. And it's absolutely true that the people who walk through the door, 6% of them will be sober 2 years out. That's absolutely true, okay? So what he was saying has some validity. But this is how I responded to him. He was a psychiatrist, this guy. I wrote back, let's say that you came up with a cure for an illness, and you knew without a doubt that everyone that would undergo your treatment for that illness would get better, and you started it in a hospital. And you invited 100 people to come and with that illness to experience your treatment for it. And you knew it was going to work. And what happened was 100 people came to the hospital, but 90 of them sat in the waiting room talking about their illness, sharing about their illness, grateful that they have their illness. But only 10% would go in and undergo the treatment for the illness. Would you say, would it be accurate to say that you only have a 10% recovery rate from your treatment? Mm-hmm. And he wrote me back saying, no, obviously not. Only the 10% should be counted. Well, I said the same thing happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. 9 out of 10 people come into the meeting and share. And they think that is what's going to help them get recovered. They're going to share their way recovered. In our literature, it doesn't say anything like that. It says there is a solution. The solution is the 12 steps. I am telling you, one out of 10 people that come through the door even get started on the steps, let alone go through them. So rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That is still true. But you cannot count the people who come through the door, sit in a chair, and expect to get it from osmosis. This thing takes work. It took work for me. I was sitting in the meeting before I knew that you were supposed to do the steps. I thought, you know, I'd just double up on my meetings. And I'd be sitting in a meeting like this, you know, with about 3 months sober, and people would come up to me and they'd go, Chris, how you doing? Fine. hey, Chris, what's going on? Nothing. Everything's good. You know what was going on in my head during the meeting? I'd be sitting there, oh, listen to this guy. Oh, my God, listen to this guy share. Oh, man. Oh, the hypocrisy is dripping off of this guy. Oh, no. Oh, what's his name? He's raising his hand. Oh, please, God, don't call him. Don't call him. Oh, my God. Oh, no, they're calling on him. Oh, now I got to hear him share about his family. Oh, now he's talking about gratitude. Oh, he's grateful now. I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll go outside, I'll slash all four of his tires, I'll follow him out of the meeting, and I can watch gratitude in action. And this is what's going on in my head, and I'm sitting here like this. Oh, thank you for sharing. Oh, my God. That's what was going on in my head, okay? I need recovery. I don't need more sobriety. I need recovery. Oh, my God. And sometimes we are so sick, we don't know how sick we are. The book says it. The book talks about it. The book talks about us not understanding the difference between true and false, not understanding right from wrong, not having that capacity to grasp just what the hell is going on in our life. And that happens with people. Sometimes what we have to do is we have to develop a skill set to be able to approach the still sick and suffering alcoholic. We need to develop a skill set. We need to be good at drawing these people in, gaining their confidence, and then hopefully somehow explaining to them what the problem is so that they will grasp the solution like the drowning sees life preservers. That's basically what it says in the book. We must grab this thing like a drowning person would seize a life preserver. And, you know, do we do that? Do we do that normally? No, we're like, oh, wow, man, Tuesday? You know, that's us. So as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, what happens is, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carry this message to other alcoholics, and we need to get good at it. Mm-hmm. There are too many people dying out there from alcoholism. And so often we sit in these rooms, we're a bunch of recovered people, you know, who got it. We have to remember to try to track down the people that don't have it and offer it to them. Nobody else can help. Do you think this psychiatrist that charged $200 an hour, you think he's really going to help any of us? I don't think so. It's not my Freudian complexities that are the problem. It's my head. I want to kill people, you know? I would do much better with a sponsor that's a plumber. You know what I mean? I would, but you cannot shrink my head. It's not going to work because I'm not going to be honest with you anyway. You know? Oh, man. So the problem, this is an enormous problem. Alcoholism is aggressive. It is unorthodox. The way it presents, the way alcoholism presents, we don't give it credit. We don't give it sufficient credit for how it presents. Because if we have a bad day, if we like have problems with personal relationships and our boss is a jerk and everybody driving on the road today is an idiot or a maniac and our family doesn't understand us and our friends aren't loyal, you know, they're always letting us down and all these problems that we have going on in our head, if we don't know that that's alcoholism, we're not giving alcoholism its due. Because alcoholism is a spiritual malady. It's an emotional malady. It centers in our brain, and it affects absolutely every aspect of our life. We sometimes think that we're suffering from life on life's terms when we're in the middle of an alcoholic maelstrom. And we think that just because we're not stopping at the liquor store today, everything should be fine. Everything should not be fine. If you have separated from alcohol and you do not have a spiritual program and you're not busy and about that business, everything should not be fine. And if you've not gone through the 12 steps and you get drunk, don't look to me to be surprised. You know what I mean? You're not supposed to stay sober if you don't do the steps. Read the book. Read the book. That's what it says.
You want to take a 15-minute break?
Yeah. We're going to take a 15-minute break.